بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
The Sacred Defense literature is not a literary genre like other literary genres. It is like a bubbling spring where we can create all kinds of literature. We can use sacred defense literature to produce excellent historic, political, romantic, and familial texts, and also to produce such materials for that literature itself. However, the important point is to produce text. We need to produce text. If good and eloquent texts are produced, then we can use them to write plays and to make movies. For example, I have heard that one of our committed poets has composed 10 ghazals, benefiting from the book written by our eloquent martyr, When the Moonlight Was Missing. Very well. If committed poets enter the arena, they can compose tens of collections by utilizing sacred defense materials. Poetry is a great art. The same is true of movies and the cinema. We should produce cinematic works and the like. This is being done in the world as well.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord,
my Lord,
protect me from dishonor. Me faith to be stronger among
In other countries in the world, too, perhaps the best cinematic works are based on excellent writings and texts. They use the outstanding and excellent novels that have been written before. We should do the same. We should produce these outstanding texts, and we should make movies and plays and then put them on the stage. So, it is an important task. I have heard that inside the country, they put on the stage the works of foreign writers such as Victor Hugo and Charles Dickens. Very well. We should also do something to make others in other countries, first in our country and then in other countries, put our writings and texts on the stage and then produce movies out of them. In other words, we should focus our efforts on producing outstanding writings. Another point is about commemoration ceremonies. Commemoration ceremonies are an important discussion and a great task as they help bridge the gap between generations. They help young generations become familiar with the sacred defense. This will be effective in building personalities like Shahid Hojaji or other dear martyrs of defending the holy shrines. Of course, this is also another blessing and auspicious outcome of the sacred defense era.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you.
in the limelight.
Scientists have identified an old piece of the Pacific Ocean, the ancient remains of its long-ago seabed, extending hundreds of miles underneath China as it is pulled downward into Earth's mantle transition zone. This rocky slab that used to line the bottom of the Pacific is a relic of the oceanic lithosphere, the outermost layer of Earth's surface, composed of the crust and the solid outermost parts of the upper mantle. The lithosphere isn't always destined to enjoy the views up top, however. The upper surface layer is composed of several fragmented tectonic plates, which slowly move and shift around at the surface, occasionally running into each other. What you just heard were words selected from a scientific article penned by Peter Dockrill under the heading Ancient Fragment of the Pacific Ocean Found Buried 400 Miles Below China. Stay with us for more on this topic. Scientists have identified an old piece of the Pacific Ocean, the ancient remains of its long-ago seabed, extending hundreds of miles underneath China, as it is pulled downward into Earth's mantle transition zone. This rocky slab that used to line the bottom of the Pacific is a relic of the oceanic lithosphere, the outermost layer of Earth's surface, composed of the crust and the solid outermost parts of the upper mantle. The lithosphere isn't always destined to enjoy the views up top, however. The upper surface layer is composed of several fragmented tectonic plates, which slowly move and shift around at the surface, occasionally running into each other. During these collisions, a geological process called subduction can occur, where one plate gets forced under the other at subduction zones and ends up being driven ever deeper into the planet. In a new study, scientists have now witnessed this epic phenomenon taking place at greater depth than ever before observed. Prior to this, scientists had recorded subducting slabs probing the boundaries at depths of about 200 kilometers. Now, thanks to a giant network of over 300 seismic stations spread around northeastern China, researchers were able to see the event at a much lower point, imaging parts of the tectonic plate that used to lie under the Pacific Ocean being pushed into the mantle's mid-level transition zone at depth ranging between 410 to 660 kilometers below Earth's surface. To interpret the sinking slab, the team identified two seismic velocity discontinuities, regions far underground where seismic waves encounter anomalies. In this case, two anomalies were encountered, which the team says related to both the top and bottom sides of the plunging plate. Based on detailed seismological analysis, the upper discontinuity was interpreted to be the Moho discontinuity of the subducted slab, says geophysicist Qi Fu Chen from the Chinese Academy of Sciences. The lower discontinuity is likely caused by partial melting of the sub-slab asthenosphere under hydrous conditions in seawar portion of the slab. While the plate subduction can be seen in process below China, the subduction zone itself lies far to the east, the slab being angled at a relatively shallow 25-degree angle downwards. Japan is located about where the Pacific plate reaches around 100-kilometer depth, says seismologist Frangin Niu. Thanks to the new imaging, scientists are getting a better idea of what happens to a subducted slab when it reaches this part of the transition zone. including how deformed it gets and how much water content it loses from its oceanic crust. A lot of studies suggest that the slab actually deforms a lot in the mantle transition zone, that it becomes soft, so it's easy deformed, Neo says. We are still debating whether this water is totally released in that depth. There is increasing evidence that a portion of the water stays inside the plate to go much, much deeper.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Amir Kabir. Khayyam. Maulana, Avicenna, Khwarizmi.
Iranian notables, sources of global honor.
In the name of God, salam, dear listeners, and welcome to the program. In this episode, you will get more familiar with the Iranian poet who lived in 7th and 8th centuries AH, corresponding to 13th and 14th centuries AD. He was Seyf Faraghani. Seyf Faraghani has been known as a leader of socio-political poetry in Farsi language. The 7th and 8th centuries AH were among the bright eras of Iran's literary history, as masters of poetry and Gnosticism like Maulana, Sa'di, and Hafez lived in that era. We have said that little is known about his life and times. You also heard that Saifuddin Abu Muhammad Muhammad Faraghani was born in Transoxiana and left his town Farghane for Asia Minor, current Turkey, in youth. He lived the rest of his life in Aksaray, a small town of the region. Dear listeners, you also heard that the Iranian society was so much chaotic due to the Mongol invasion that most of the literary figures and poets lived in fear and tried to survive. What one finds in the works of that era mirrors the pains and misery of people under the Mongol rule. The sufferings of masses were reflected as complaints in the works of poets and writers, or in the form of comedy and farce of poets such as Sa'di Shirazi and Obeid Zakani. There were three groups in the turbulent conditions of that era. The first group was the laymen, who didn't understand the causes of the existing conditions and just tolerated them. The second group consisted of politicians who had assimilated themselves with the rulers to preserve their worldly gains. But the third group comprised of responsible writers and men of letters who would either try to advise the ruling class or castigated them through satires and sarcasm. Many researchers believe that literature is the idea of a nation, and a society can be known through reviewing the content of its literature. Like many literary figures across the world, Iranian writers and poets have touched upon social issues of their era. Late Dr. Shafi Katkani said, "Literature and literary texts represent the social ups and downs. In other words, they are considered the most important documents of every country." European researchers Volk and Warren maintain that art is a pre-portrayal of nature's engagement with society in a way that a picture of the artist's or writer's social realities can be found in art and literature. Poets and writers are impressed by social and political developments of their era. An examination of the works of the poets of Farsi language indicates that they have a lot to say about the developments that have not been mentioned in history. For instance, the writer of the books, History of Iran's Constitutional Period and 18 Years of Azerbaijan's History, achieved untold stories of the history of the region and its unknown rulers that cannot be found in any document. Literary works are very important for familiarity with the ideas and mentality of the people of a specific era and region. These works are, in fact, unofficial references of history. Seyf Faraghani was an ascetic who felt responsible for the sufferings of his people and tried to mirror them in his works. He was a mystic too. Mystic poetry had existed in the Farsi literature, but once this genre of literature mixed with social pains, it turned into a sore on the head of corrupt and cruel rulers. The poetry of Seyf is the same sword and cry. As a matter of fact, dealing with the social problems of people used to exist among Iranian poets, but few poets have mentioned these problems as explicitly and caustically as Seyf Faraghani. The poetry of Seyf Faraghani is the poetry of shouting against oppressors. He neither sat idle in the face of the Mongol invaders, nor did he compromise with them. He protested vociferously. His poetry was the voice of the human conscience. That's why his poetry is alive after the passage of over seven centuries. His poetry functions as a beating heart. It is like a history that a truthful writer has authored. It is a clear perspective of the Ilkhanid rule in Iran and Asia Minor. Seyf Faraghani has left a divan or collection of poetry consisting of 10 to 12,000 lines. His poems can be divided in odds, lyrics, and quatrains. Late Dr. Zabihullah Safa has written an introduction to this book, which includes delicate and precise scientific points on his life and thought. A brief look at his divan shows that he had lofty ideas and believed in social progress, unlike many of his contemporaries. Social responsibility and spiritual values matter for him. Well, dear listeners, next time we will continue this discussion.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. A joint statement by EU and UK says that following intensive work, the two sides can now announce their agreement in principle on all issues with regard to the protocol on the two islands. After lots of 10 months, differences still remain on governance, fisheries, and standards. The UK is speaking of removing some controversial clauses from the internal market bill, while the EU has negated any undue sacrifices to secure a trade deal with Britain. Are the two sides going to remove the remaining obstacles to a deal on future trade ties within the limited time left? Stay with us for a debate on that issue. Let's first go to our London bureau. Saeed Puriza is there. Saeed, tell us about the London side of this prolonged, process of discussions and talks.
The agreement today will be removing the controversial clauses out of the internal markets bill, caused uproar not only in European capitals but also in the U.S. It is being received as welcome news, but is it being treated as a breakthrough into trade talks? Probably not. The honest answer to where these negotiations stand, a trade deal between the UK and the EU, is that really no one knows which way these negotiations are going to go. Both sides have painted a gloomy picture of it all. Number 10 saying today that the chances of a deal are not very good. As a matter of fact, most recently, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said, and I quote, "You have to be optimistic. You have to believe in the power of sweet reason to get this thing over the line. But it's looking very, very difficult at the moment. The key thing," he said, "is that whatever happens on January 1st, that's the day after the December 31st deadline, things are going to change and people ought to get ready for that change." On the European side, the chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, who has been very optimistic all along and has kept things smooth, has been quoted as saying today in a meeting with heads of states that the chances of reaching an agreement with the UK are now very slim. So as you can see, very gloomy on both sides, both parties to these negotiations. Realistically, the only people who know the answer to where things are going, what will happen next, are two people: the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who will be meeting at some point this week. And of course, this comes after a lengthy phone call between the two of them. I think it was yesterday or the day before, that really didn't break the impasse in the negotiations. As you said earlier, what we need to look at again is what's happening on the edges of these negotiations. Perhaps look at the internal politics in the UK, the agreement today between the Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove and his European counterparts vis-a-vis the internal market bill. Perhaps that might send a signal that the UK is willing to compromise, because so far the two sides have been very recalcitrant, if you will, in their positions. The UK not really budging over fisheries and those two other issues, such as the level playing field or the state subsidies to businesses, as well as the issue of governance. Those three stumbling blocks still remain in the way of a trade talk. So the UK position seems to be just the same as the EU's. Both sides seem to want a deal, but at the same time, they're not really ready to make any compromises on their positions. And as I say, both sides saying that the chances of a deal don't look very, very good at this point.
Okay, appreciate that, Saeed Puriza, London Bureau. Now, joining me in this debate first will be Director of the Seven Investment Management, Justin Urquhart. Stuart is joining us out of London. Good to have you with us, sir. UK Cabinet Office.
Thank you.
UK Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove has expressed delight over reaching an agreement on post-Brexit arrangements for the Irish border. Is this a breakthrough that could facilitate the trade deal eventually?
Your commentator from London was absolutely right. No, it wasn't really a breakthrough. Frankly, this was almost a rather strange, well, it was a very strange action taken by the government previously on this. And in many ways, it was almost set up to try and actually almost annoy the EU in their negotiations, and then to be able to give away on it later in time, to be able to say, well, actually, we've now given something back to you. It's a negotiating ploy. Actually, I don't think that really worked. It just served only to annoy absolutely everybody, and especially the Irish, and also, of course, the Americans as well. And this came up during the presidential election. So I'm afraid, as your commentator said, we're still waiting to see whether there's going to be a final agreement. But as often with European affairs, it's often right at the last minute that something may well be pulled out of the bag.
Well, Justin, the Johnson administration has announced that it will remove law-breaking clauses from the internal market bill. That's been a source of concern for the EU. Would that go through Westminster, you think?
Yes, it would go through. That would actually be approved because there was a lot of anger, actually, because of it was seen as really the United Kingdom going against international law, being seen to breach an international agreement that it had with the EU. And that would be very bad in terms of reputation. Obviously, that sort of reputation when you're doing international deals, well, as having people going back on their word, no, not their word, on a signed treaty, I'm afraid would be seen as a very bad precedent indeed. And frankly, I think an awful lot of the politicians were seriously embarrassed. This is not the sort of thing you would expect from the United Kingdom government.
Mm-hmm. Okay, also joining us on this debate show will be journalist and commentator on international affairs, James Tweedy, out of Plymouth. Good to have you with us, James. Let's have your opinion on this agreement that Michael Gove talked about, and if you think that this could kind of help facilitate the future trade relations and clinching a deal on that front.
Well, what this seems to do is tidy up the withdrawal agreement that was agreed back in 2019, more than a year ago, about a year ago. And it deals with certain disputes that have arisen around Northern Ireland and, you know, the provisions on Northern Ireland. And so that, okay, that seems to tidy that up. And that, you know, that at the very least says that the withdrawal agreement, the original withdrawal agreement, will be maintained. Neither side is going to break it, and neither side is going to pull out of it because the other side has broken some of the provisions on it. So, okay, that's one thing. It doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be a deal, because everything I'm reading about this right now says that the EU is still asking for the same things it was 6 months or a year ago, that Britain must continue to abide by rules that it makes, including new rules that it makes. But, you know, we've already left the EU, but from now on, and that European fishermen should have, you know, almost the same level of access to British fishing waters for a very long period of time, at least 10 years. So that's not going to fly necessarily unless the British government decides to cave in on those issues, which, I mean, everything they're saying is that they're not going to do that. So, okay, they've said many times they're not going to do that. If they do, then it discredits them. So, yes, it's hard to see where this is going to go. I mean, there are, you know, sources who say that actually Michel Barnier is the one who's responsible for this, along with the French government. He was self-isolating for a few days after one of his team tested positive for COVID-19. He couldn't really play much part in the negotiations, even virtually. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the EU Commission, took over and started to make some concessions, because I think what the Germans, she's German, right? What the Germans want is they want to be able to sell motor cars and other heavy industrial goods in Britain without tariffs. What the French want, well, okay, they make a lot of cars and things too that they export to us, but, you know, the kind of lobby of the farmers and the fishermen there is politically more powerful, perhaps, and they want to maintain this kind of, you know, they want to keep having that access to our fisheries.
I'll go back to London. Justin, Boris Johnson hopes, I'm quoting him, the power of sweet reason will allow the UK and EU to reach a post-Brexit trade deal this week. Are you optimistic this is going to happen?
Well, I was optimistic the past few days, but maybe more pessimistic. Well, put it this way, it would be incredibly stupid for the British government not to have a deal. Brexit in its own right is already going to make the country, the economy, smaller anyway over the next few years. And by not having a trade deal, that's going to make it even worse. Now, it's going to actually impact not just on confidence within the United Kingdom itself, but also inward investment confidence. And, of course, one of the key areas that has been ignored on this, really, has been the Japanese car plants, where they assemble Japanese cars in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom was very willing to accept these to be developed. And the deal, particularly with Nissan, was really they saw Britain, the United Kingdom, as a gateway to Europe, not as a destination. And so, therefore, when the threat of Brexit came up, Nissan made it abundantly clear that unless we have exactly the same position we're in now, then the next round of investment in the next series of cars will be going to Barcelona in Spain and not to Sunderland in northern England. So it remains to be seen that if they don't get that, we don't get that deal coming through, whether the Japanese follow through on that. And although they have said they would invest in Sunderland, actually we also know that there's a backup. They may well reverse that decision. So for Boris Johnson, despite his own political problems with inside his party, with a lot of Brexiteers in there, actually economically it will be very difficult and very dangerous for this economy, especially with regard to the key elements of our financial areas, which is actually the City of London and financial services, which earns a huge amount of money for the UK economy, whereas of course actually fishing, which is very emotional to many people, with people going out and actually risking their lives fishing and such like, but economically is almost irrelevant to the British economy. And so therefore they must get a deal, and frankly the fishermen should not be getting in the way of it.
Now, James, Michel Barnier has stressed on his Twitter page that, quote, access to our market comes with conditions. What conditions is he alluding to?
Well, he's talking about this regulatory alignment where we have to follow the same rules as the EU that they set, but we don't have a say in, and that we shouldn't, and part, some of those rules include that we are not allowed to give any kind of state aid to industry, you know, which could be defined, by a judge. So it could be, you know, almost anything. It could be like the government giving contracts to one company and not another, perhaps. But, you know, certainly it would prevent, you know, it did not prevent the great banking bailout during the credit crunch. It didn't make any objections to that. But it has in the past prevented the British government from saving steel makers in this country, which is quite an important industry, or it used to be. It still is significant in this country. So then we have Bombardier, there's a company which is based in Canada but has operations in Northern Ireland. That has been accused of, the EU has been accused of giving state aid to that, to Bombardier by the US. And then the EU has also accused the US of giving state aid to Boeing, you see. So now Bombardier is going to be our responsibility. They make passenger jets. So if we keep, subsidizing them to produce those jets in Northern Ireland, which has got quite a depressed economy, then maybe the EU will say, no, that's not good, can't do that. So this kind of thing. So actually any kind of what you might call a progressive social democratic policy is actually kind of banned by the EU. Lots of those kind of policies are banned by the EU because the government can't intervene in the economy, you see. So these are the problems. I mean, another thing I'm going to say is that, he says, can't have access to your market unless you follow our rules. Well, okay, the people who voted to leave never actually felt any great benefit from the EU, and actually they felt that they've actually lost things, like many people lost their jobs, because we used to have a much larger car making industry in this country, and after we joined the EU a lot of it was shipped to Eastern Europe. The factories moved to Eastern Europe, production of companies like Ford, which was exclusively in Britain and the east of London, moved to Eastern Europe. So, we've lost out because of free trade. So actually losing free trade with Europe isn't such a bad thing, we trade more with the rest of the world than we do with the EU now, and trade with the rest of the world is growing 10 times faster than trade with the EU. It has been for the last decade. So, you know, the trends are that Europe is not so important. I say Europe, I mean, the European Union, which doesn't include the two most important countries in Europe, which are Russia and the UK, is not that important to us anymore and is becoming less and less important. And the rest of the world is more important.
Now, Justin, the two sides still disagree on issues like fishing rights, business competition rules, and the manner of their implementation. Do you know of any solutions to those issues?
Yes, the fishing rights could actually be put to one side and be dealt with separately, because previously this was already managed by way of licenses which had been issued to various countries and to the fishing industry in those countries. And in fact, the United Kingdom's fishing industry has actually sold their licenses. So this is an issue which has already been dealt with separately and, frankly, is getting in the way of this particular element. And the problem is it's become a very emotional subject, which, of course, the media has picked up on. And, of course, it's always very emotional with sailors going out and catching these fish. But as I said before, it's actually not actually that important. In terms of subsidies overall, it's fascinating because, of course, one government's investment is another country's subsidy. Europe's been having subsidies or investments for years doing this. So, it's a matter of interpretation. Now, what the EU wants to make sure is there isn't going to be any unfair bites in terms of supporting industries. And I suppose that's only going to be to be expected. But Britain does need to be part of the trading unit. As James was just saying, trade elsewhere around the world has been growing. But Britain's largest trading partner in the world is the EU, the largest trading bloc in the world. And in terms of actually the value to us of that, it's very important. But also, don't underestimate the amount of value that actually the UK is to certainly countries like Germany and the exports of their cars coming through. But really one of the key elements has been some of the infrastructure which is so vital in Europe, certainly in terms of scientific infrastructure, investment infrastructure and things like that, which Britain will now be missing out on and has already been losing out in terms of some of the jobs and future investment. So any particular deal wouldn't necessarily reverse any of that process, but it still makes sure that the United Kingdom has access to the free market. If you don't have access to that, you immediately start seeing tariff rises, and the operational structure of moving elements without barriers across the not just the English Channel, but also across the Irish borders as well, will cause operational difficulties. And that's an unnecessary cost, which the United Kingdom does not need.
Okay. Now, James, we have 1 minute only, and this is the last question. Johnson has spoken of difficult talks, but promised there are great options ahead of his country on any view. What is he talking about?
Well, he's being optimistic. He's saying that Britain will, as he's said for years now, that Britain will thrive when it's outside the EU. It will, it has opportunities. Certainly, Britain can, as being independent of the EU, can sign trade deals with other countries, which it already has done, and it doesn't have to wait for the EU's approval on that. Staying within the EU customs union would have prevented us from doing that, for instance. So, there's that. And I suppose he's still saying he's optimistic of making a deal, even though essentially all progress has been set back to square one. But there it is. What else can I say? I'd just like to answer something that Mr. Stewart said. I should stress that Britain has far higher standards than most European countries when it comes to things like labour standards, food standards, consumer standards, health standards. We're one of the countries with the highest minimum wage. That's why British manufacturing jobs have been offshored into Eastern Europe, for instance.
Okay, we're out of time. Sorry, I got to jump in. That's all the time we have.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, let me thank our guests. We had Director of Seven Investment Management, Justin Urquhart-Stewart, who joined us from London, and journalist and commentator on international affairs, James Tootie, out of Plymouth.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Reaffirming its unwavering support for the Zionist regime of Israel, the United States took radical steps to reject International Criminal Court's authority over its citizens and territory, suspend visas to International Criminal Court's personnel and their families, and condemn the Palestine investigation and any other action that seeks to target Israel. U.S. Hawk Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has repeatedly and wrongly referred to the court, the ICC, as an embarrassing political renegade and unlawful so-called court and a vehicle for political vendettas, masquerading as a legal body. In order to shield U.S. and Zionist regime occupiers who have committed war crimes, U.S. President Donald Trump even issued an executive order imposing sanctions on the ICC prosecutor and ICC investigators. Some commentators have expressed doubt that Joe Biden, who has been projected by the U.S. media as the winner of the 2020 presidential election, will be willing or able to reverse this course of action and hostility towards international justice. Confronted by a deluge of politically motivated accusations, the International Criminal Court need not sink to the level of its detractors. Its founding treaty, the Rome Statute, requires the court to stand for justice, determined to put an end to impunity for the perpetrators of international crimes. We're prepared for you an article written by Raji Surani, the director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights based in the Gaza Strip. The piece is titled Palestinian Case at ICC Legal, Not Political. The article has been taken from the AlJazeera.com website. Please stay with us for more of Raji Surani's article. It took International Criminal Court ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda 5 years to conclude her preliminary examination of the situation in Palestine, which found a reasonable basis to believe that war crimes have indeed been or are being committed in the occupied West Bank, including in Eastern Al-Quds and the Gaza Strip, and thus to initiate an investigation. Fatou Bensouda's statement on 20th of December 2019, announcing the end of the inquiry, was met with widespread enthusiasm by victims and human rights organizations alike. But the celebrations came too soon. The ICC prosecutor found that the standard of proof for the commission of war crimes was met, and that opening the investigation was appropriate and in the interest of justice. Nevertheless, instead of proceeding, she sought confirmation on the scope of the ICC's territorial jurisdiction from the pretrial chamber. She asked the chamber to take a decision within 120 days. Nearly a year later, victims are still waiting for that decision. As a Palestinian lawyer in the Gaza Strip, I've spent 30 years representing victims of war crimes and crimes against humanity across the occupied Palestinian territories. Since 2009, I have represented the Palestinian victims of Israeli crimes in Gaza, before the International Criminal Court, the ICC, a last resort to ensure the most serious crimes of concern to the international community do not go unpunished. Today, I'm increasingly frustrated by the court's painfully slow progress. It is true that international criminal proceedings are typically longer than domestic cases, but it is hard to understand why the substantive investigations into the crimes committed in occupied Palestine have not commenced, despite the evidence uncovered in the prosecutor's preliminary examination. The International Criminal Court prosecutor's decision to ask the pretrial chamber to confirm territorial jurisdiction in Palestine and consequent delays risk jeopardizing the effectiveness of the investigation. This wasted precious time and has played into the hands of certain political actors who have attempted to detract from the seriousness of the court's preliminary findings of war crimes. Most notably, the Israeli Foreign Affairs Ministry has published a position paper which attempts to divert attention away from the gravity of the crimes which have been committed and direct it towards the old question, is Palestine even a state? This argument champions a legal and moral absurdity. There can be no victims of war crimes in Palestine if Palestine is not a state. In January, the pretrial chamber issued a call for the submission of observations on the question of jurisdiction. In response, 43 amici curiae legal opinions were submitted from third states, international organizations, legal scholars, and civil society by the 16th of March deadline. Most submissions did not limit themselves to the technical question of territorial jurisdiction as requested, but interpreted this moment as an opportunity to make claims about the statehood of Palestine, the legitimacy of the proceedings, and their political appropriateness. However, the chamber did not follow up with a timely delivery of its judgment. The politicization of this case engulfed the International Criminal Court proceedings from the very beginning, echoing the fate of previous attempts to seek redress for violations of international law in Palestine through legal mechanisms and forums. A delegitimization campaign was launched against the court, with accusations ranging from taking a political stand to espousing anti-Semitic positions. Reaffirming its unwavering support for the Zionist regime of Israel, the United States of America took radical steps to reject International Criminal Court authority over its citizens and territory, to suspend visas to ICC personnel and their families, and to condemn the Palestine investigation and any other action that seeks to target the Israeli regime. U.S. Hawk Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has repeatedly and wrongly referred to the ICC as an embarrassing political renegade and unlawful so-called court, and a vehicle for political vendettas masquerading as a legal body. In order to shield U.S. and Zionist regime occupiers from committed war crimes, U.S. President Donald Trump even issued an executive order imposing sanctions on the International Criminal Court prosecutors and investigators. Some commentators have expressed doubt that Joe Biden, who has been projected by the U.S. media as the winner of the 2020 presidential election, will be willing or able to reverse this course of action and hostility towards international justice. Confronted by a deluge of politically motivated accusations, the International Criminal Court need not sink to the level of its detractors. Its founding treaty, the Rome Statute, requires the court to stand for justice, determined to put an end to impunity for the perpetrators of international crimes. The only valid approach is for the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to tackle the question as a strictly legal one. In this sense, in concluding her preliminary examination satisfactorily, the ICC prosecutor could have opened the investigation directly. There was no legal requirement to submit a request to clarify the territorial jurisdiction of the ICC, the International Criminal Court. Therefore, her request has brought a heated political debate into the courtroom. Resolving it once and for all at the preliminary stage of the proceedings will avoid incertitude and more unbearable delays in the decision. This strictly judicial approach is not divorced from the reality on the ground. Instead, it acknowledges the critical situation of the victims of Israeli occupation, for whom this court represents the only and last resort. Abandoned by the international community, unable to access any Israeli foreign or international tribunal, and subjected to a cruel occupation, the fate of the Palestinian people is now more than ever tied to that of the International Criminal Court, the ICC. Now the court is at a crossroads. It can yield and collapse under Israeli and US pressure, or it can choose to act upon its object and purpose to ensure that international crimes committed against Palestinians do not go unpunished.